ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of the most ambitious projects in human history.
It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect.
For decades, the breakthrough has been just around the corner.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in for David Marr, who's got the dreaded winter lurgy. Hopefully he's tucked up in bed with a bowl of chicken soup and making a speedy recovery. In a couple of weeks, we'll all sit down to fill in the census, that five-yearly survey of the nation that informs billions of dollars worth of government policymakers for years to come. This year, there'll be a few new questions in the mix around sexuality and gender. They're relatively small changes, but ones which demographers say could make a huge difference. Liz Allen from ANU joins me later. We'll also investigate how Australia's farmers have become so dependent on the herbicide paraquat, a toxic yet highly effective weed killer. Despite health concerns and growing bans around the world, it's still widely used here, increasingly supplied from one of the countries where it's banned, China. But first, to the United States. Bruce Shapiro is contributing editor for The Nation and executive director of the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Bruce, it's 6 months now since the Iran war started, which President Trump said would take 5 weeks. Vice President J.D. Vance has posted on X that Iran is essentially on its last warning, but we've heard that before. Is the U.S. any closer to finding an off-ramp?
One-word answer. No. Longer word answer, this war at the 6 month mark, which let's remember was started by the US and Israel together, right, is in some ways further from resolution than it has been in quite a while. We had a week of absolute macho testosterone chest thumping by Donald Trump last week, in which he was saying, I'm going to start bombing again. I'm going to make things worse. But of course, he then backed off immediately. Trump is boxed in, and the Iranians are counting on it. What is so striking this week is that at the 6 month mark, the Iranian regime is stronger in several ways, despite the physical destruction of big parts of the country and the physical destruction of its own leadership. The Iranian regime has far stronger nationalist support behind it. And for all of the talk about its potential nuclear weapons, Iran now has been handed, essentially, control of the Strait of Hormuz, which turns out to be a stranglehold on the global economy, which has given the Iranian government more power than they've had in generations. So this is an extraordinarily difficult moment for Trump. It's also a difficult moment for Trump politically. His own party, the Republican Party, and some of the most powerful people on his own side clearly regard this all as a quagmire or a sand trap, if you will. Politically, the war is no more popular, in fact, less popular now in the United States than it was. So it's sort of hard to see what the Trumpian off-ramp is going to be. Unless it is simply declaring victory and withdrawing. But, diplomatically, there's not a lot of room to maneuver here. I think the same needs to be said, in fairness, for the Iranians, right? The Iranian regime knows that its support in its own country is not endless. There's not a boundless appetite for destruction. There's not a boundless appetite for war. So this is both parties are struggling with how to maintain broader public support amid appealing to their own more militant base, amid dealing with the military reality and economic reality of the situation.
And what about the pressure on President Trump being squeezed, if you like, between what's going on at home and on the other side from Israel?
Well, certainly we've got Bibi Netanyahu coming to Washington today, ostensibly for Senator Lindsey Graham's funeral, one of the strongest backers, not only of Israel generally, but of military containment of Iran and a kind of military ally of Netanyahu's. And Netanyahu understands that Trump so often seems to listen to the last person in the room. And, you know, he wants to be the last person in the room again, despite Trump a few weeks ago, really getting very publicly angry with Netanyahu and where the war has led. It is a strained alliance on this. Netanyahu wants the war to escalate. Trump's own allies in the Republican Party, with the midterms just a few months away, see high risk in this. They don't have a stomach for it. And what's more, there's an additional pressure point now, which is the military itself. This war has greatly depleted American supplies of Patriot missiles and of other military systems that are costly and time-consuming to replace. And there is real fear from the kind of military technocracy that this could weaken America's overall position in the Mideast and other parts of the world. So the calculus around this war, which was rushed into 6 months ago, has gotten very complex.
Bruce, tell us also about the criticism that the Pentagon is facing over minimizing the number of U.S. casualties. How have they done that?
Well, this is really remarkable, and it's a measure of the kind of political desperation of the White House to try to hold its core public opinion. Traditionally, military casualties, soldiers killed and wounded in war, are listed in a single place on the Pentagon's website. The Defense Department, under Secretary of Defense, officially Secretary of War, he will say, Pete Hegseth, has started to break up those statistics, change the categories in which people killed and wounded in combat operations, change the categories in which they are put. And that has two impacts. One is that it literally kind of buries the bodies in two different places on the Pentagon website. You have to go to two different places to get a comprehensive picture of casualties. And by changing the categories of some of those casualties in the war, it may also change the benefits that veterans, or in the case of dead soldiers, their families are entitled to. And this is politically just enormously risky. At this early stage in the war, to inspire anger and betrayal by veterans and soldier military families is to take an enormous political risk. It is also, though, as I said, a sign of the desperate desire of the White House and Pentagon leadership to somehow change the spin on this war 6 months after it started.
Now, let's look ahead to the midterms. The Democrats are trying to overcome a scandal with their candidate in Maine. Tell us what happened and how much of a setback this is, because we know one of the elements of genius, I suppose, that you could attribute to President Trump is that he knows how to dominate the media. Whether it's good, bad or ugly, they're only talking about him. And in the meantime, there's very little talk about what's going on with the Democrats. But what sort of situation are they in at the moment because of Maine?
Well, and in Maine, of course, there was a kind of fiery, out of nowhere, progressive populist Senate candidate, Graham Platner, who was accused by former partners of sexual abuse and indeed sexual assault. He quickly dropped out a few weeks ago, and after some internal wrangling this week, the Maine Democratic Party selected another progressive, this one a very experienced state legislator, Troy Jackson, who had previously run unsuccessfully for governor, and who seems poised to capture the same progressive base, the same young base that was ignited by the Graham Platner candidacy. Maine is important. It's a little state at the top of New England, but it's tremendously important because it's one of the few swing states, one of the few where Democrats seem to have a strong chance of recapturing a Republican-held Senate seat. In this case, it's held by Senator Susan Collins, who has, on the one hand, a history of sort of a moderate Republican, but who has repeatedly voted with Trump on key issues like the Supreme Court. And the Democrats in Maine and nationally believe that Susan Collins is deeply vulnerable and that the road to a Senate majority, which Democrats desperately want, runs to a great extent through Maine. The reality is that to get a Senate majority, Democrats in a few months' time need to capture four Senate seats. Maine would almost certainly have to be one of those. There's a few others that are up for grabs, Michigan, Colorado, Texas, maybe up for grabs, interestingly enough. There's a lot of really interesting debate. But in the meantime, within the Democratic Party, we've had a round of primaries and another coming up this week in Michigan that are about a war within the Democratic Party itself, a struggle between incumbent Democrats and progressives, in some cases Democratic socialists, who have been campaigning hard to unseat incumbent Democrats in primaries. We have this going on in Michigan. We have it going on in the Senate seat in Massachusetts, which is already a progressive versus progressive state, but it's also about youth versus age. We've had it happen in Colorado. In the primaries, progressive Democrats and Democratic socialists seem to be having a moment. What we'll find out this week, first of all, in Michigan, is whether it's the moment has passed or if it's a movement within the party that's going on, the sort of Mamdani momentum, if you will, or if that's kind of transient. And then we'll find out in November whether this insurgency motivates voters, brings in new voters to the Democratic ranks and helps them take back both houses, or, as Democrat establishment figures fear, if it will alienate independent and moderate voters and, in fact, make it harder. There's a big argument going on within the Democratic Party right now about that. And it's a party that also has lots of structural and fundraising problems far behind the Republicans in the amount of money they've been able to raise.
So this sort of shift towards progressive populism, if you like, since the success of Mamdani, will it be looked at state by state, or will they become a sort of critical mass where they say, okay, this is where we're heading now? About anyone who doesn't feel like shifting in that direction, but this is what we need to do.
Well, that's what we're going to find out. It already is clear that Mamdani's success as mayor of New York City, progressive insurgency against traditional machine Democrats, if you will, has inspired a lot of people to run. It is a national wave of campaigns. And look, I will say there have been in my lifetime a few other moments like this when either at the state level in state legislatures or for Congress, progressive Democrats have been able to challenge their more moderate or kind of machine-oriented Democratic incumbents. Turnout in American primaries is typically fairly low, and that makes it pretty easy for highly organized insurgencies to seize seats. We've seen this in the Republican Party too, going back to the Tea Party and the whole Trump movement, seizing seats from more moderate Republicans, right? So it's kind of easy to do that. The harder thing is A, to then translate that into votes and in the general election where turnout is much higher, and B, then to translate it into holding on to majorities in the legislative bodies long enough to govern, right? That's sort of the big question. Now, on the turnout side, this year Democrats are hopeful, and the biggest fear that the Republican Party has is a dispirited, low turnout election on their side, with Republican voters or conservative-leaning independent voters staying home. That is, the polls indicate that may be going on, and there's a real chance of what they consider a Democratic wave election because of the economy and because of alienation of more moderate voters from Donald Trump. His hardcore base will show up, but motivating larger numbers of Republican voters seems to be a problem.
And we also know the president's trying to push through changes to voter rules, and we'll have to check in with you next time on just how he has succeeded or not with those. Bruce, good to talk to you.
As always, Tracy.
Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation, executive director at the Global Centre for Journalism and Trauma. Coming up, the weed killer, Australian farmers can't quit. Around the world, bans on the controversial agricultural weed killer, paraquat, are spreading. The EU, China, Malaysia, Brazil, and most recently the US state of Vermont are among the 74 jurisdictions globally that have made the chemical illegal to use on farms. Here in Australia, though, our chemical regulator made the long-awaited decision last month after a nearly 30-year review that paraquat can continue to be used in Australia with stricter safety precautions. It was a decision that disappointed some health advocacy groups concerned that long-term exposure to paraquat could be linked to Parkinson's disease. But the peak bodies representing farmers and growers insist that they need these weed killers to do business. Just last week, though, one major paraquat manufacturer, Syngenta, pulled out of the Australian and New Zealand markets. The situation raises the question, how has Australian farming become so dependent on these chemicals? And as more nations institute bans, where is future supply going to come from? Sarah Rogers is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Melbourne. Sarah, how long have paraquat herbicides been around?
They've been around for a long time. So the original product came from ICI, the precursor to Syngenta, in the 1960s.
And they're still controversial. They always have been controversial, haven't they?
I suppose, but over the years, our understanding of their toxicity and their impacts on human health and the environment have developed. And so we probably have a much better understanding of their impacts these days.
And so why is it that it's been so popular with farmers?
Look, it's a bit of a long story. So over the past couple of decades, Australian farmers, particularly in broadacre farming, so large-scale grain production particularly, have shifted to what is called no-till agriculture. So when previously they might have sort of tilled the soil as a way of controlling weeds and preparing for planting, over the past decades, they shifted to no-till, where there's no tillage, and so to control weeds, they are using chemicals instead. So that's a fairly long-term change, and it means that Australian agriculture, broadacre at least, is very chemical-dependent.
And can you tell us how paraquat works?
I mean, I'm not a toxicologist. I don't really, and I'm not a chemist. I don't really know exactly how these different active ingredients work, but I can tell you how paraquat is used in farming. So it's typically used in conjunction with glyphosate, which is another herbicide that people are probably quite familiar with. And it's used in broadacre in what is called a double knock application. So you come through usually pre-sowing and come through with glyphosate, and then maybe a couple of weeks later you come through with paraquat to kill off any of the weeds that have come up despite the use of glyphosate.
So what about the health concerns? How long have they been around?
I mean, I think they've been around a very long time simply because paraquat is so acutely toxic that it's often been used in suicide, for instance, and been implicated in poisonings, etc. So we've always known how acutely toxic it was. But I suppose the longer term links to human health are newer.
Mm. And, you know, there are stories, aren't there, about damages to lungs, kidneys, liver, the cardiac system, an entirety of bodily systems.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not a public health expert. And farmers would tell you that it all depends on how it's used. So they would say if we're using it in enclosed systems and we're not coming in contact with the herbicide, then we don't have any of those impacts. It's a safe product to use.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that, you know, there's more than 400 lawsuits against Syngenta that are pending in the US and Canada, which have been filed by individuals diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. But until fairly recently, the industry was dominated by just a few companies. What has changed?
So what has changed is that the supply of agricultural chemicals in Australia is now dominated by one supplier. That's China, and it's dominated by generic products. So that means rather than the old sort of patented products that you saw coming out of Syngenta and Monsanto, those older companies, you have the rise of generic products that are produced largely in China, and they're produced at scale and they're produced for much less cost. And that has become a really important pillar in the supply of agricultural chemicals to Australian farmers.
Yeah, and I just find it astounding that, you know, they can't be used in China, but China can ship them here and we still can. I mean, this is, I guess, what we're wrestling with right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do have very different farming systems to China. So, I mean, paraquat wouldn't be particularly useful because China doesn't have a lot of the big broadacre no-till farming systems that we have.
Mm.
But certainly those products are being produced in factories under export-only registrations, and so they're only produced for export, and Australia is one of the main destinations.
And I guess through all of this, it has been helped along by the trade agreement between China and Australia.
Yeah, it has to some degree, but I think this process of the rise of generics was already very much underway. And so these products were already fairly cheap compared to the brands, even before CHAFTA, even before the free trade agreement removed tariffs.
So how easy or difficult is it for these companies to register a new paraquat product in Australia?
Oh, look, I mean, if you look at the list of products where paraquat is an active ingredient, it's something like 120 different products in Australia, which, I mean, that's a huge kind of smorgasbord to choose from, right? So at some level, because this is an old active ingredient, an old chemical that's been approved for use for a long time, it does seem to be fairly easy to register a new product containing that active ingredient.
So what's interesting about your recent research is that you've traced back the origins of these chemicals. What did you find?
Look, we traced them back to the extent that we could. There's all sorts of problems with data availability here. That starts in Australia. It starts with the kind of level of detail that we have about what is imported into Australia, what is sold, what is used on farms. We really don't have very good pesticide use data collected by the ABS or anyone else. And then obviously the Chinese production side is quite difficult to trace as well. So we went to Chinese language sources, used, you know, the product registration databases and tried to work out, you know, which ones were registered for export and which ones were coming into Australia. But by no means is this a finished task because there's just so many problems with this data all along the supply chain.
Yeah. The two leading agricultural chemical retailers in Australia, Nutrien and Elders, they've also got their own low-cost generic labels. Where do they get their source generic formulations from?
Look, in our interviews in the industry in Australia, it was estimated to be, anywhere from kind of 60, 70, 80% of these generic products, including Elders and Nutrien's generic brands, were coming out of China.
So if we talk about Syngenta, and we mentioned the company before, how significant is it that they have now decided to pull out of the Australian market and the New Zealand market?
Look, to be honest, I don't think it's very significant at all. As I said, there's something like 120 products on the market with active ingredient, paraquat active ingredient. I think maybe three of those, possibly four or five, are produced by Syngenta or the ChemChina kind of umbrella. And so, look, it's just not that important to the Australian market, and they're also not the main supplier of those generics. So all of those generic brands remain and remain available. So, yeah, Syngenta withdrawing is not, in my mind, that significant.
So you mentioned previously that, you know, the farming groups, they use this no-till farming and they say they can't do that without paraquat. So what would the alternatives be?
Look, they say they can't do it without paraquat because of herbicide-resistant weeds. So over the years, as you apply more and more chemical to particular weeds, they build up resistance. And so that's why paraquat is being used in the first place, because glyphosate resistance is a huge problem in Australia. So you apply glyphosate, it doesn't have the desired effect. So paraquat comes into that as the stronger tool to really knock down those herbicide-resistant weeds. There are a couple of other chemicals in the mix that farmers can use as well. There's a relatively new one called glufosinate that some people suggest might sort of take the place of paraquat. But whether it's paraquat, glufosinate, 2,4-D, whatever it is, we're using a whole lot of chemical to grow food.
Yeah. And it sounds like using herbicides is also a lot cheaper for the industry, for the farming industry. And if they weren't able to use these herbicides, that would bring in a whole other complicating set of factors.
Yeah, certainly. So the generic products mean that these chemicals are sort of cheaply, widely available. But the other issue, I guess, is the kind of makeup of farming in Australia. We don't have a lot of labour. We don't have a lot of people farming anymore. And so it's always about efficiency and cost savings using new technologies. And that's where AgChem really comes into the mix.
How difficult was it for you to talk to people right across the board about this topic?
Look, my research has always been in China, and I've always dealt with the very difficult politics of doing research, sometimes on sensitive topics in China. And to be honest, I've never found research so hard as doing, doing the work that we were doing with the ag chem industry in Australia. It was very closed. There were some people that were really generous with their time, really willing to kind of talk us through what was going on and how the market was changing, but there were barriers at every step, and I found it really quite challenging to do this research.
How long did you spend doing it?
I mean, it wasn't a single project. It sort of rolled from looking at changing farming practices within China to then trying to sort of map the pesticide industry within China and then looking at the supply chain into Australia, particularly for paraquat. So, yeah, that we've been doing it for at least sort of 2 or 3 years now.
By the sounds of it, if you had the option to do it again, would you?
I would, because I think it's so important. I mean, the other side of this that we didn't even begin to touch on was chemical fertilisers, which are also kind of essential to Australian farming, and also phosphate fertilisers are mostly coming out of China. And so these kind of dependencies in the supply chain, I think it's really important that we understand them.
So let's go back to the decision made by the Australian Chemical Regulator. Why did it take so long? I mean, 30 years is not a quick turnaround, is it?
No. Look, I haven't really followed the politics of this closely, but it seems bound up in some institutional issues with APVMA, bound up with kind of conflicting science and how to sort of assess that science. There's been a lot of heavy lobbying from industry groups around paraquat, diquat in particular, to keep it available for farmers. And then it was, I think it was Murray Watt a few years ago who really pushed to have the review come to a conclusion. But then it still took a couple of years after that. So, yeah, it has been an extraordinarily long review process.
So it must have been quite interesting for you to watch what was happening around the world and these different jurisdictions putting their own bans in. Do you get a sense that you think the bans will continue to spread?
I mean, possibly for something acutely toxic like paraquat, when it's not actually central to farming. So that's why you see bans in, you know, Malaysia and China and Brazil and other places. But in a place like China where it's, like Australia, where it's become a really central tool in farming, I think it's going to be a very slow process of weaning farmers off this particular chemical and introducing either additional chemicals to use in its place or other kinds of farming practices in its stead. Yep.
But is there a will for that?
No. There is not. In our interviews with industry, it was a fairly strong and consistent message that paraquat was an essential tool. There were no other chemicals that acted like it, and that the result of taking paraquat off the market would be a whole lot of land coming out of production. That was the message we got.
So I imagine it's a pretty strong lobby group that is, you know, appealing against any sort of ban being put in here, as is happening elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a unified sort of group by any means, but you do have very, very strong actors in this space, the NFF, CropLife, et cetera, with very consistent messages.
Now that you've done this research, what do you hope will happen with it?
Look, I really want people to understand more about how their food is grown. And how we grow food in Australia. And just to kind of, you know, hopefully have this broader discussion about how we want to grow our food, what we want those inputs to look like, and to think strategically that we are so dependent on this single supply chain, because it's a very good supply chain, it's very reliable. China's very good at producing these chemicals. But is that what we want? What does that mean for our food security? What does that mean for our food sovereignty?
We also sell a lot of food back to China, don't we? That's another interesting concept in all of this.
It is, yeah. It's like the old circle of poison, but a fresh take. So we import the chemical from China, we grow the grain, and we ship the grain back to China with presumably the residue of those chemicals still on that food.
And I wonder, Sarah, through this process, has it changed the way you eat?
It has. To be honest, I mean, organic products are out of reach for most people because of the cost. But if I was going to kind of select the things that I bought organic, top of the list would probably be things like wheat, because I know so much more now about the chemical use on these sorts of farms.
Well, I feel like we could talk about it for a very long time, because it's one of those stories that has tentacles that go off in many directions, doesn't it?
It sure does. Yeah, it really does.
Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tracy.
Sarah Rogers, Associate Professor in Geography at the University of Melbourne and co-author of a recent article in the Journal of Agrarian Change on pesticide supply chains from China to Australia. Coming up, the curly questions in Australia's looming census survey. In a couple of weeks, the nation will sit down to fill in the census, that critical compulsory survey of the nation that happens every 5 years, administered by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's the best sense we get of who we are, how we live, and where. And there are a few changes in store this year. For the first time, over 16s will be asked to voluntarily identify their sexual orientation and sex recorded at birth. There'll also be room for more detail on cultural ancestry and for describing the ethnic makeup of a household. The updated census comes after a messy political episode a couple of years ago when the government promised new census questions on sexuality and gender, then backed away, before backflipping again to allow their inclusion. The demographer Liz Allen from the Australian National University has described the looming census with its new additions as the most progressive in our history. Liz joins me from Canberra. Hi, Liz.
G'day.
Tell us what the new questions are exactly.
Yeah, so there are a number of changes to the existing content to enable a better reflection or a true reflection of the diversity within Australia. And so there are a number of tweaks to a few aspects throughout the topics in the census. But importantly, there are two additions to the census this time round that caused a massive brouhaha in a political sense, which led to an enormous political interference, the likes that we haven't seen in modern history. But these two additions are fundamentally important to capturing a more complete picture of who we are, and that's often been hidden within the census. And that relates to sexual orientation. And that question simply asks about how does each person in the household describe their sexual orientation? And the categories go straight, gay or lesbian, bisexual, uses another term and enables a free text, and then don't know and prefer not to say. And it's a voluntary question. It's one of only three now that are voluntary. And the other addition is gender. Now, presently, and we've always had a collection of sex, but this time round, the wording around the question of sex goes a little bit differently, and it asks about the sex of each individual as it was recorded at birth, and it includes three categories: male, female, and then a third category that includes no option for the addition of a free text. So that's problematic because it doesn't quite get to intersex yet. But the other interesting addition is one of gender. And that asks what a person's gender is. And the categories go woman, man, non-binary, uses another term, or prefers not to say. The departure from the sex and the gender question are about one of biology and one of social embodiment.
It goes beyond the biology, which is how you were identified when you were born, male, female, and into this more social aspect where people can identify as a gender other than the one they were given at birth.
Indeed. And these two questions are important side by side because they give a greater indication of not just what we were recorded at birth as, but how we then embody and live our lives day to day. That is important for service provision and so on. But the Australian Bureau of Statistics, when they created these standard classifications for how this data could be collected, knew that they were unlikely to get it in the census. And that's because the government of the day, say, for example, in the 2021 census and in the 2016, but most importantly at the 2021 census, knew that they were unlikely to get it past the government. So they didn't make recommendations to the government to include these additional items. But they suspected, come the next government, the Labor government, that they were more likely to get it in. And so there were talks as far back as 2018 about the 2026 census getting these more wholesome data in, fulsome data. Now, what then happened, though, was something quite extraordinary. We know from FOI requests now, that Freedom of Information requests, that the minister responsible for the ABS, that is Dr. Andrew Lee, basically signed off on the regulations and so on, which is a kind of a process by which the kind of the census ball starts to roll, if you like, in terms of planning, that these items would be tested and included in the testing. Generally, what gets tested gets included in the final census. Then what happened, though, is we had a captain's call from the Prime Minister. We had Anthony Albanese say, hold up, we can't have that data included. And so this has been nicely phrased as, in an attempt to avoid a culture war, Anthony Albanese started one. And so I think it's quite nice, right? Because that's essentially what happened. We had like people going, yeah, it should, you know, we're in agreement that these items should be included. And then they said, no, they're not. So they're not going to be included. And then on the day that he basically announced these things, Albanese flew out of the country and we were all left here going, what the what? What do we do? We had people scrambling. We had a media announcement cancelled by the poor folks at the ABS. It was nothing short of an expletive firestorm. And then basically what happened is they did some massive political gymnastics and they decided that after that big brouhaha happened that maybe they should be tested after all. And so we had this extraordinary situation and I think a lot of undoing of goodwill, I think, that many of the public had put into getting behind the census after, who could forget, the census fail of 2016. So we're kind of seeing the ABS regain trust and hope almost that there would be this more progressive nature of data, and then the government couldn't stomach it. We have never seen this kind of political interference, this overt political interference. The problem is now what we've seen is the exclusion or lack of inclusion of people specifically of intersex. And so what that means is that we've kind of... we're halfway there. We're a work in progress in this regard.
Actually, why don't first go back to 2016? What was all that drama about?
You make
the census sound so interesting.
It is like people will say, look, it's just a questionnaire. Oh my heart. It is more than a questionnaire. The census is a family photograph of us. And what happens when it comes to data items, I really, really stress this. What is counted matters, because at the end of the day, what matters is counted. Now, I know that feels a bit like a mental gymnastics, but what goes on the census is a signal of what is vitally important information-wise to the nation. But deep down in Australia, we're sceptical people. We've rejected the Australia card back in the 1980s. We've avoided the notion of a population register, which is the alternative to a census. And we're sceptical of government, a healthy level of scepticism. And so,
is it scepticism or conservatism?
I wouldn't say it's conservatism as it relates to concern over data collection, and that's because it lies in the notion that what is the government going to do with my data?
Mm.
And history tells us that censuses in the global history have been misused in the past.
Mm.
But I do agree that the census tends to be by way of data items on the more conservative side. And it has to be. The reason being is because the census must be understood by every household in Australia. So the census needs to be pitched at a language level that is understood, a comprehension level that enables understanding of every single term and definition used within the survey. And so, and that's important because the questions must be reliably and consistently understood household to household. We can't have my household, for example, assigning a particular definition to a particular term and then my neighbours either side interpreting that in a different way. The data is going to be bad.
Yeah.
And that's bad for everyone because, as New Zealand has proven, incomplete data means the death of the census. And we were looking, we were staring down the precipice of the death of the census in 2016. Let's cast our minds back to that. We had a lot of concern around data safety, data security, the potential misuse of data. Now, that could have been related to the government of the day, and that concern about the potential misuse of data. And the current statistician, Australian statistician, the head of the ABS, I mean, he even admits that the census is a honeypot for hackers. So in 2016, we had all of that furor occur before the census. And then come census night, we thought we could all us data nerds thought we could, breathe. We put our census pants on and we had our census parties. There was pie. There was census pie. Then what happened? The website fell over. And, like, you couldn't make this stuff up. There was, crisis that, where the census was being attacked. There was a DDoS attack and so on. There was lots going on. At the end of the day, the router became overwhelmed and could have been fixed by switching it off and on again. So you just can't make this stuff up. Anyhow, so fast forward, we got the census done. Fortunately, it wasn't that bad. And if you want to follow up about what happened there, there's lots of postmortem on the ABS website and other government websites around the 2016 so-called hashtag census fail. And then come 2021, we're in the middle of COVID lockdowns.
Mm.
And so a lot of people didn't have a lot to do. And so the census was like, this is like a break from, you know, having to look at your partner or deal with the children. Like it was something quite wonderful. And as a result, we had an enormously high level of participation. And so people really got behind the census because a lot of countries postponed their census during COVID times. We were, you know, an outlier. We were at the forefront of this data collection. And as a result, we have phenomenal information that we will be able to look back on this particular COVID census. And now we've got to this point. We've got a lot of changes, that didn't happen and so on. But in amongst all of these government flip-flops around the 2026 census, there were forms printed off that were all ready to go to get tested to like 60,000 folks. They all had to be pulped because of elbows, captain's call, interfering. Like, it's like you think, wow, this census has got to be the most exciting thing that ever happened, right?
Well, I mean, the way you've painted it, it has to be.
Liz. Well, it's not. You know, look, if we can go back to very early censuses and like in the 1800s before the, you know, in the late 1800s, there were fires that burned entire districts' census forms. There were accusations of interference and malfeasance and people lighting fires to things to get rid of these forms. It was just an accident. But like, we have these controversies throughout our history. But it actually paints an incredible story about us and the fact that we've gone from census via horseback to now census via online digital communication for the majority of us. And what is so fantastic about our census is because the real estate is, you know, it's very difficult to come by on the census form, and a lot of work goes in to ensure that every single data question and item is used as much as possible by as many people as possible in the country when it comes to policy, research and local councils and so on, that it's used and maximised in a way. And homelessness is the perfect example of this. There's no question on the census that goes, are you homeless?
Mm.
But the ABS, using the data that's asked around number of rooms in the house, number of people living in the home, they can comprise the most comprehensive indication of homelessness that actually shows in 2021 that in the midst of COVID lockdowns, we could see that it's not rough sleepers that comprise the bulk of people deemed homeless. It's people living in our suburbs, in homes, in severely crowded circumstances. And that's what's so powerful about these data, is that we can use this information to push the boundaries of what we know about ourselves and to advocate for change.
Liz, I think this is the best thing about the census, is that we have an idea of who we are, but this gives us a much truer picture, perhaps, of those parts of us that we don't often recognise as we go about our daily lives in our own little bubble. But we'll have to get you back on. We need to do a census series. You need to invite us all to your place on census night, because I reckon there'd be no night like it.
There's got to be party hats.
We'll bring those along. Liz Allen, demographer at the ANU on this year's looming census, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is the show for now. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in while David fights the winter lurgy. Get well, David. And I'll be back tomorrow. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.